Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Mary Kay Jensen describes herself as a recovering grants writer. After retiring from California State University, Chico, she pulled out some boxes of trip diaries, which became the raw material for a memoir. She earned a doctorate at the University of Oregon, where she was an analyst and author of the Federal Research Clearinghouse, ERIC. She has experience in teaching, school psychology, administration, and public speaking. She is a survivor of cancer twice and of decades of travel with an irrepressible spouse. The title of her memoir is Rudy's Rules for Travel, Life Lessons from Around the Globe. Mary Jensen, welcome.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
Now, you have experience as a grants writer and some of this other information. You are an analyst and author of Federal Research Clearinghouse. What does all that mean,
what
Mary?
What does all that mean?
Yes.
Okay. Well, starting backwards with the ERIC Clearinghouse is a clearinghouse for the study of promising educational practices. So things that have been researched, tested, and have some chance of being valid in the classroom. And while I was a graduate student at the University of Oregon, I was employed by them to review hundreds of research reports and sift out the ones that look like they had the most promise for classrooms and then write their summaries about them and guides to how to use them. And so that was there. And I forgot the first part of what you asked.
Well, I was just asking what your previous work involved when you were a grants writer.
Right. And grants writer, I directed the special education teacher preparation program on campus. And one of our goals was to give financial support to our students as they went through that extensive training to be special ed teachers. And so our activity was to write grants to the federal government for stipends for our students and for our ability to conduct research in special education.
Now, speaking of supporting students,
yes,
you continue to do that, and you have an event coming up this Saturday that provides scholarships to students. Tell us about that.
Thank you. Yes, on April 28th, we'll be meeting at ABC Bookstore from 11 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon, and I will be donating the proceeds from the sales of any of my books that are sold that day. And our cause is, the sponsor is the American Association of University Women, the Chico branch, that's AAUW. And our cause is to provide scholarships for young women who are graduating from our Chico high schools, from all of them, and to contribute to the community, Chico Community Scholarship Association. And, you know, our hearts are with that project, and so we're hoping it's a big day. And we're hoping everybody comes and buys a book or gives us a donation and sees us there. So again, that's April 28th from 11 to 2 at the ABC Bookstore on Mangrove.
Well, you have been involved in education your whole professional career.
It's true.
How far back does that go?
Oh, it goes a long ways back. that's a really good question. It goes back from the time I was out of my master's program, which was Loyola Marymount campus, and when I got my first teaching job. And then until I retired, about 5 years ago that I finally fully retired.
My guest is Mary Kay Jensen, and she has written a memoir, Rudy's Rules for Travel, Life Lessons from Around the Globe. Now, you write your book. You are already an adult. You're already married. But as I was reading it, I kept wondering, how did she meet such a character as Rudy?
You can't believe this. I met him. I found him in the Chico School District. I came to Chico by mistake. I thought I was going to apply to Chino.
You were living in Southern California
at
the time.
Exactly. I was in South Central Los Angeles, and there was the town called Chino.
In fact, I recall one time when our governor, Schwarzenegger, visited Chico, and he thought he was in Chino.
Well, I had a similar experience. And so I got the invitation to come to an interview. It was my first job as a school psychologist. I'd been a classroom teacher and then finished my master's, and I was really anxious to use my new license and be a psychologist in the schools. So I was sending resumes everywhere, maybe 50 I sent out, because I was desperate to get – I also needed a job, and all my money had gone to tuition up until that time. So I sent out – all my queries and my resumes, and got this phone message from Chico Unified School District. I thought, that doesn't sound right. And I looked on the map and found out it was way above. I've never been that far north. I had no idea there were,
in California, that is.
Yes, in California, that is. Right. I'd never been that far north. And so I called them to tell them that it was a mistake and that I was a Southern Californian. And I talked to Marge Covell, and I don't know if any of your listeners are going to remember Marge Covell. And Marge Covell said, there are no mistakes in life. You need to come and meet us, young lady. You need to get on a plane and come see us. And then we'll talk about whether this is a mistake or not. And I said, oh, okay. So it was a free trip. It sounded like a really good deal to me at that time. I didn't have any money for travel. So I thought, okay, I could do this. Got up here and I met the Chico people and Bidwell Park. And knowing both Bidwell Park and the Chico people was enough to tell me that Chino was not the right move. So it was the best mistake of my life. And then I met Rudy within days after I was hired. He was a principal in the Citrus School in Chico, Chico Unified. And Citrus School was one of my schools. And I thought he was a pretty fascinating character. I didn't know how fascinating, but he was pretty fascinating.
Well, you learned little by little, I suppose, about his European background.
Exactly.
Did you know when you met him how much travel was a part of his life? Or maybe it wasn't then.
I knew a bit because he had been born in Hamburg and had come to America when he was four years old.
Now, you have a picture in the very front of your book.
Yes,
this
my
adorable
favorite picture
child.
Of this little child.
Describe that child.
Okay, he's 4 years old, and he's going to be riding on the big boat to America. His daddy has just asked his friends who are sailors to just kind of look after the boy. And so he has no kind of supervision on the ship.
In fact,
all.
He's dressed like a sailor.
He's dressed like a sailor.
He's a cute little sailor suit.
And he's saluting.
Yes.
And his curls are sticking out from underneath this little captain's hat. And the part I like best, though, is the two legs. When you look at the 2 feet.
I noticed one foot was
rolled
over.
Did you notice that?
Like,
you know how little boys will do that when they're standing in line or anything. But there he is saluting with a smile. But
in fact, that's what I thought you were going to say your favorite part of the photograph was, that adorable smile.
Oh, no, it's the shoes. It's the feet, the way they...
Okay, so this is how he happened to come to America then.
And then he was raised in Washington, D.C., but he was a German-born citizen. He was a citizen of Germany, and his parents never applied for U.S. citizenship. So when the war started, World War II, he was an enemy alien and, had no obligation to join our military. But he begged and begged. For 2 years, he went to recruitment offices asking to be part of the war on the side of America. And
because Germany was our enemy.
That's
Here's
right.
Here's this young man,
German-born,
saying,
to
I want to fight for the USA.
Well, he was very, probably all his life, he was very intellectual, too. And he was able to differentiate between the German people that he loved and the families that he knew there and their government. So he understood that he would be fighting their government. But our armed forces weren't as quick to understand that, and neither was his father. His father was a Hitler loyalist, and the tension in the home was palpable. The FBI had raided as the war started and taken Rudy's, I think it was his binoculars and his Brownie camera. But still, he wanted to fight in the U.S. military, and ended up going to Tibbenham, a little village in England, where he was placed because he had volunteered. And that was the only way he could get in, so it was to volunteer for the worst of it. So he had volunteered for the bombing missions over Germany. And usually one-third of those missions come home. Yeah. And he flew 35 missions and lived through them. But from that, he just learned to value every part of life. He loved every part of life.
Well, now, you said something that jumped out at me in your book at one point. You say, you make the distinction, or it's the person that you were quoting, makes the distinction between a people and their government.
Yes.
And as I travel these days,
does.
I'm hoping that the foreigners that I meet will make that distinction between me and my current.
You know, we have to hope that. Because we don't know.
My guest is Mary Kay Jensen. She has written a memoir, Rudy's Rules for Travel, Life Lessons from Around the Globe. So you meet this principal, you say.
Right.
And how long before the two of you said, you know, this is a good match?
Right. I would say almost a year. Mm-hmm. And we tried traveling together. That was his acid test, you know, to see.
if I can stand could, him for
it. Right. And that was mine, you know, I was, oh, my gosh. And so we tried traveling together. And that was working all right. It took a lot of adjustment on my part. Because I always felt like I was holding a hot air balloon by the tether, you know, trying to keep it grounded.
Well, at one point in your book, you say the tornado that was Rudy.
It was. He was the tornado. And I felt kind of caught up in that tornado.
And it was not your nature, because so many times you mentioned how different your styles of travel were.
Oh, my. Right. That never changed, which is, I mean, I got a little more adaptive and a little braver. But not so much, you know, not as much as would have made it more comfortable or more compatible. But yes, we had different styles. He was very, for one thing, he on top of being pretty fearless, which he had learned as a bombardier to be pretty fearless. On top of being pretty fearless, he was such a cheapskate. He was just terrible.
That's part of the challenge of traveling then, is to find the best deal, huh?
Oh, yes, and find the best deal, that was the challenge, and it was so that you could come back again next year. You had to go home with your money. And so we ended up sleeping in some of these strangest of places. And it was not my idea of this European vacation by any means. There was no resemblance to what I thought we were going to do.
Well, when I was reading your book, I was thinking of my late husband, because I often thought of him as Indiana Jones. In fact, he was even a professor at Indiana University. And I thought, gosh, here are my friends that I grew up with, married, settled down, had two children.
Right.
And here I was off on an adventure. And you described your husband as fearless.
Yeah.
Because some people, you put them down in a strange city and they would, I think, contract. And what in the world am I going to do? You put my husband down in a city he'd never been in before. He'd be, oh, boy, what can
I
find here?
It gets that blood going, as Rudy would say.
And it was very helpful for me to become, I don't know if fearless is exactly the word, but to capture that spirit that he so thrived on.
Yes.
But it sounded like you still were a little hesitant. Well, things could go wrong here.
I did have a thinking style that I think is with me all the time, but particularly in, you know, foreign travel, where I have to think of all the things, the bad things that can happen before I can make sure I'm safe, you know, that I've protected myself against all the bad. So I run whereas Rudy never took time to, and never wasted time to think of the bad things that could happen. And I always tried to educate him.
Well, it sounded like he did the educating, because you call the subtitle of your book is Life Lessons from Around the Globe. And I assume that he was one of the main teachers of these life lessons that you learned.
He was, and the places were. You know, the people, one of the themes of the book is that in more independent travel, like not group travel,
yes,
but independent travel, and slower travel, and more in tune to the people travel, because Rudy particularly would be the one that would kind of buy clothes or buy a jacket or shoes that match the people, mm-hmm. so that he didn't look so
stand
American,
out as a,
which might be a tip.
Yeah. But then sometimes you looked American enough to give you away.
Exactly. You know, my little California sundresses, you know, they kind of gave us away.
Well, I thought of you, too, in describing some of these trips into controlled countries.
Yes.
Because my husband and I also like to do our own arranging. We didn't go for tours, but at the time we went to China, that was the only way you could go. And you were not allowed to do anything on your own. You always had a guide. You were always supervised, guided where you could go and where you couldn't go. And I was reading when you're going to these countries where there's so much control. But now Rudy found a way. He could sneak away. We were able to do that when we were in China.
Yes. But in Russia, we were in Russia in 1983. And it was, as you say, it was controlled. It was after the downing of the Korean passenger jet. And the state embargo had just been lifted. And we were the first group to go through after that. And so we did have to go through in a group. But yes, Rudy would put where he would for that trip bring clothes that he thought would fit in really well. And then he'd go off and meet the people and go to the museums and end up in trouble with the police and the metro, because you're not supposed to take pictures in the metro. But it's so beautiful, he couldn't resist, and, you know, on and on. But he for that reason, I think he fit in. And the guide that we had from I believe it was called Interest then. The guide from Interest.
You're talking about Hannah.
Yes. The one who was the actual Russian guide. She was, purposefully not making a scene with Rudy. You know, you could feel her, you could see her clenching her teeth.
Kind of reining in what she really wanted to say.
And reining in what she really wanted to do to him, right? And then she would pretend not to see that he was missing and never to ask me why he was out on his own. She didn't want to know.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'll be back with my guest, Mary Kay Jensen, after a short break. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest, Mary Jensen, is a former grants writer who has written a memoir about traveling with her late husband, Rudy. You mentioned, we've kind of mentioned in passing a couple of his rules. One is, how did you word that about looking for a good deal?
Always look for the free lunch.
Yes. Look for the free lunch.
Look for the free lunch.
Yeah, and you don't feel that that's not one of your rules.
No, I was raised by an accountant, and our family rules were you get what you pay for, and there's no such thing as a free lunch. I learned that from when I was 3.
So what's another of Rudy's rules that he followed?
I think one that was really most significant, you know, in terms of opening up the travel to us, or opening us up to the travel we were experiencing, was about riding with the locals and not the tourists. Get out of the tour buses. Get off that cruise ship. And find the local buses and the BIMOs in Indonesia and the little prop planes. But ride with locals, particularly the buses where they in their... And he always thought it was most charming that you could meet their livestock also on the buses or the barges or the ferries. But wherever the locals went, you went. And if it cost an extra quarter to be on the first class barge, we did not spend the quarter.
Well, when you're traveling this way, you're less of a tourist.
And that's right.
What my husband and I always like to do too, ride the buses that the locals, not the tourist bus, but ride the buses that the locals ride. And it does help to speak the language wherever we were. And I noticed that your language, you could get by. Rudy knew enough German from his childhood. He could get by in German.
And his came out as he traveled. He didn't know German in America. When he traveled to Europe, he knew German. The context, brought it out.
Yes. And you traveled in a lot of places that sometimes they did speak English. I mean, so much of Europe now speaks English.
Yes, right.
But some of these places you went to, they did not speak English. Right. And they spoke Russian. And some of those times, Mary, were pretty scary that you describe. Something was awry. And especially the mere fact that you were American.
Yes. Not always a loved country.
So the fact that you were American mean they took extra care in looking at your passports and your papers.
Oh, yes.
To make sure everything was in order.
Well, I think they were shocked that we were there on our own. And I think, it was just it was too out of the ordinary for them to deal with because they were used to having small groups come through, not even large groups, but probably small groups come through. And so it threw their bureaucratic structure, to know what to do with this.
Yeah.
And we were too naive, and I can't tell you why we didn't learn over the years, but we didn't. We were too naive to figure that part out, to figure out that if we're on our own, we're going to be on our own to explain ourselves in the what are we doing here, and to be followed. We knew that would have to happen. And I guess it was just that we hadn't been there yet, and so we needed to go. Does that make sense?
It does. And when you say naive, I thought about myself years ago when we were in a country under a dictatorship and these automatic weapons, you'd see guards with these automatic weapons. And when we got ready to leave the country, we were a year, and stepped at the airport, stepped outside in the international zone, and my husband went, whew. And I hadn't really known enough to be worried. And then I thought, my gosh, they could have, on some pretense, thrown us in jail and thrown away the key. And we couldn't have done anything about it.
Right. There's no way that you're going to be able to contact your embassy, for instance, if you can't find it. But yeah, exactly. It's a different world once in those days it was the Iron Curtain and the Berlin Wall. Once the wall goes up, it's a different world on the other side.
Because you did a good bit of traveling in that part of Europe.
We did. And it was, for Rudy, it was a matter of being able to understand the Soviets because of his war experiences. And the history buff in him, wanted to know more. And it was also for him a matter of just kind of checking off the countries and that he'd been to all the ones that he'd always wanted to go to and never had a chance to. He, at one point before I met him, had led a bicycle tour of high school students, all teenagers. And with pretty much success, you get a couple in a group, but pretty much successful tour. And they had been gone all summer, 3 months, so they had covered all of Europe. And so he was intent on seeing Eastern Europe because he had seen Western Europe. For me, it was not so exciting, but for him, or I should say it was more too exciting. It was more exciting than it was for him. But for him, it was just ordinary travel, things you have to put up with.
Well, this was in France, but it was a pilgrimage where you had people from walking this pilgrimage. And this woman had left her walking stick. And so I saw that she'd forgotten it and I hurried to give it to her. And she was totally impassive. She showed no expression. I mean, you'd think they'd say, well, acknowledge, well, thank you for finding my walking stick for me. And I got no reaction. I thought, well, that's odd. And I thought, well, maybe because I tried different languages with her and she, no reaction. And so I think it was a couple of days later, at least a day, I ran into her and I thought, I wonder why this kind of reaction. So I started just talking, engaged her a little bit. I don't remember what language. And finally, her face it kind of like it softened. And she said, I was raised in Eastern Germany. And said, we had to learn Russian. We studied Russian her whole school time. And she seemed resentful of that. And she actually seemed like a nice person. But
that's so interesting. That's parallel to something that happened to us in, I think it was Hungary, where the cab driver was telling us that the children learned Russian for 12, at that time, took Russian lessons for 12 years.
And they didn't
have
a choice. They had to. It was required.
But funny thing, they can't remember any.
That's it.
That's what she was telling you.
Because they did not want to do it. They were being forced against their will.
Funny thing, you said.
Yeah. My guest is Mary Kay Jensen, and she has written a memoir, Rudy's Rules for Travel, Life Lessons from Around the Globe. So one of Rudy's lessons, well, you look for that free lunch.
Right.
What's another of his lessons?
One of his is never shower alone. It refers to his clothing. So he would usually take just one, at most two changes of clothes. And then when it was shower time at night, he would put them in the shower, on the foot of the shower, pour in a little soap, and take his shower with them, stomping them. and then hang them up so that he had them ready for the next day. And
so his shower became the laundry.
Yes, exactly. The shower became the laundry.
I hadn't thought of that because when you're walking a pilgrimage, you don't want any excess. You have a little backpack my backpack was small. And so I would wash things out.
Right, you just want to stomp them with your feet in
the
shower.
But I had never thought of taking them into the shower.
It's much cleaner.
That's such a good idea. Well, thanks for the tip, Rudy. What's another of his rules?
Oh, let's see.
Because it's one that I believe in myself about when you get yourself in trouble, what can you count on?
And I'm not catching the...
Well, to quote Blanche DuBois, you can rely on the kindness of strangers.
Yes. That came up a lot.
Oh, it has for me too.
He has this faith, and you know, I tried to latch on to that. This faith that no matter what kind of trouble you get into, that there will be some kind stranger that will come and rescue you. And we had endless examples of kind strangers that we needed help from. And
well, I was touched by the end of your book. You talk about when you first traveled again by yourself. Because after being married to this wonderful person for 45 years, we traveled together. Now, before I met him, I had gone to Germany on my own, hadn't thought a thing about it. I mean, what do you know when you're in your early 20s? But then I'm going to be traveling alone. And so I was a little apprehensive, but I flew into Toulouse in France, and I asked the shuttle driver from the airport into the city which stop I should get off for the hotel where I had a reservation. And the driver didn't happen to know, but there's this gentleman there on the bus who looked it up on his phone, and he said, I'll show you which bus stop to get off on. And so he checked that, and he not only showed me where to get off, he got off the bus with me.
Oh.
Because it was late at night, and in the streets were these young men who had been drinking.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they were harmless, but it's still a little bit scary to be a woman walking down a
Absolutely.
City street at night with these young guys there. But this older gentleman accompanied me to the door of my hotel. He saw me walk inside the door and just wave goodbye. And, you know, I almost had the inclination to turn and look over my shoulder and see if he had been an angel that just disappeared.
Right. Did he go up into the celestial area?
Yes. And so that called to mind when so many times in your traveling, some kind stranger would rescue
Rescued
you.
Rescued us.
Yes.
Exactly. And when I was traveling on my own, when I went to South Dakota after Rudy died, and I was meeting a tour group there, and they were the kindest of people. But then so was everybody we met there. You know, after we were blizzard-ined, to tell you the punchline.
Oh, my goodness.
We were
that
blizzard-ined.
That was quite a story.
Yes, they were blizzard-ined. And the people that had helped us after that, you know, all the way from the desk clerk to when we were in the lodge and we were still snowbound, there was a group called the Rural Women of South Dakota Agriculture, and they did everything for us. You know, they taught us how to stoke the fire right, and they charged our cell phones in their trucks, and they were phenomenal. And they got me out of there because they could tell I was really breaking at that point. I had had enough.
Yeah, you had no electricity.
No, I needed to get out, and I didn't have any way of reaching my family. Yeah. And so I got to go out in one of the first Jeeps that left. They gave me one of the women gave me her space.
And there was a wedding plan that had to be their clothes did not arrive. There they were in their jeans and
yes.
for their wedding.
Well, when we were at the lodge where in the Black Hills where we were so snowed in, there had been a wedding that was planned that was really to our advantage because the catering truck hadn't gotten the word that we were all snowed in. And so he shows up walking and finds out, of course, there's no
wedding.
With
a truck full of food.
It was really good food, too. I mean, we'd been rationing our food for 2 days.
And here he arrives with gourmet food.
Oh, my gosh. It was great. Shrimp cocktails and tri-tips and twice-baked potatoes. It was wonderful.
Well, you know, because as I have traveled, I have been shown kindness from so many different people.
Yes.
I thought there was such an imbalance. I seemed to be always the recipient of this kindness. And I remember one time there was a young pilgrim from the Netherlands. And it was so minor what I did, but he was so appreciative. And we were bandaging it at his foot. And he said, you know, I prayed about this last night. And so So I thought, oh, this has been my turn to be the answer to this young man's prayer.
Absolutely.
So I totally
that's
agree with that.
That's the benefit to the kind stranger.
Yes. Yeah. And so that's one of Rudy's rules.
Yes.
What other rules did he have?
He was very strong on this. He used to give lessons on this to anyone who would listen. And that's put the bucket list in order. You can't just have a random bucket list. You need to
prioritize.
You have to prioritize, and the things that move to the top are the places that are physically challenging. So the ones without handrails and the ones that have any kind of comparison to ADA, those need to go to the top because they'll be difficult for you as you get older. And to the bottom can go things like Hawaii. And cruise ships can go to the bottom. Although he had a way of dealing with cruise ships, too. And that was that he decided that the shore excursions were way too expensive. And so he would organize cost-sharing trips where he didn't take a profit, but he shared in the cost with others.
Well, because you can get off the ship and there's a taxi there that'll take you into Rome or Pompeii for a couple of dollars, whereas the cruise ship wants to charge you several hundred dollars.
Yes, and he was going to help, especially these young couples that were on these cruise ships, save their money and know how to save their money when they travel. So.
Well, one of the motivations for both you and Rudy, we've mentioned the fact that Rudy was born in Germany. And so when he goes to Germany, this is a chance to look up his family background. And then I come to the part where you also have this European connection. And what was yours?
Mine was Czechoslovakia. And it's a very emotional country. It was very emotional for me to be there. And I was looking for my roots because my grandfather, who had been missing in my life, I had never met the man. My grandfather had come from Czechoslovakia, and the family legend was that he was standing one day on the Charles Bridge in Prague and got his ideas about his life, and he walked off the bridge and walked to America. And so I had to go and see what I could learn about Czechoslovakia. And what I learned was so depressing, Nancy. It was a very difficult time. It was 6 years before the Velvet Revolution, where the artists of Czechoslovakia literally took over the country and spared it. But it was in the darkest times, and there were food shortages. We had an incredible time trying to find dinners or anything to eat. And food shortages and sorrow, great sorrow.
And yet, if you were of a certain hierarchy, you could get food.
You were doing really fine. And then the other thing we found out when we went to leave the country at last was we were in line behind these huge trucks that were their contents were covered with burlap, you know, so you couldn't see in. But as we got closer, we could tell what was in those trucks, and it was this beautiful produce. And we had never seen an orange or a berry, you know, and there they were on that truck, and they were leaving Czechoslovakia. And so it was coming from their farmlands, but yet the people were not able to partake. It was going out to get Western money. And it was heartbreaking, especially when I thought that most of them were my cousins, because I looked in the phone book, and my maiden name is really unusual. Here, like in Chico, maybe there would be one with my name. And there were page after page of my maiden name in the phone books. And so I knew these people were my cousins, and that made it worse, you know, that we were all somehow related.
So you pick up the phone and you start dialing.
Yes, right.
And the person on the other line says, oh, Mary, cousin Mary, no. How nice to talk to you.
The person on the other line says no and hangs up harshly. And I tried and tried and tried and could never get anyone to take my call. It was in English.
They would hang up so fast that you couldn't have time to thank them.
Exactly. Bye. So it was a tragic time.
So they didn't want to talk to you, and so you met a dead end there.
Right. And really thought it was fear, and I'm sure he was right.
That they were afraid
to talk
to you.
They didn't want any connection to a woman from America. You know.
Would you say even when you're there that you look Czechoslovakian?
Yes.
And
yes.
So the fact that you did.
The longer I stayed, the more. Truly, the longer we were there, the more I looked like any of the shoppers, you know, standing in the row. Because I was, for one thing, I was worn out, you know, and exhausted. And they all looked that way, too.
Well, one thing that made me laugh, Mary, was that your husband had to, it's not come to your defense exactly, but your passport photograph caused problems.
Yes.
People look at this passport and say, who is this?
In a couple of places, right, trying to get out of Czechoslovakia, they could not believe that the picture that they saw in the passport was this woman who was trying to get out of the country. And I looked like an escapee, you know, and
in person,
I looked like an escapee. The passport photos, you know, I had makeup on and I was happy and I was probably 40 years younger is what I felt like after that trip to Czechoslovakia. I felt 40 years older. And so they couldn't believe that it was the same woman. And the same thing happened to me in Berlin.
And your husband's reaction, how did he explain that away?
Well, he has a couple of ways. And one is he explained to them that if they had such hard travel, they would look that ugly too.
Yes.
My hero. My hero.
And saying, well, she's ugly because this has been a hard trip.
It's just been a hard trip and she just gets this ugly. Oh, and then he had a little man-to-man thing that he did with the Berlin man.
So you, your husband, and you're saying the Berlin man. So you go to Berlin. I don't think we've mentioned the fact that you go to Berlin.
Yes.
Because most people are wanting to go the other direction from what you're going. You're going into East Berlin.
Right.
And I think there was even somebody going with you. Like, why would anybody be going
Well, that's, and I couldn't understand why they would search the bus as if we were going to be attracting people to go into that part of the country. I don't think so. No, but Rudy had to see the Pergamon Altar and the Babylonian Wall, which I agree were beautiful, but I didn't agree that it was worth going back into a Soviet-controlled area to see these beautiful things. That part I could not agree with.
So Berlin is one of the East Berlin.
East Berlin.
One of the places you go. And so when you're in the country of your family, your ancestry, you're on the phone trying to talk to somebody with
exactly.
your same last name. So Rudy gets his turn when you go to Germany.
Yes.
And what did he do when he went to his hometown?
Well, we went to Germany pretty early in our relationship because it was something that he had to clear up from a promise to his stepmom, as his stepmother had died in Washington, D.C., Rudy had promised her that he would put white roses on her grave. And so we needed to go. Well, he took it further, and he wrote his family there, the stepmother's family, and asked if we could visit them, come by to say hello when we were there in Europe. And this was tricky because, this was the same area that Rudy had bombed. And I was terrified, that we would just cause pain for them and for us, that it was going to be so uncomfortable. But Rudy wrote him a letter and didn't mention, of course, his military service. But as he said, there's no secrets in the German family. They know. He says, my stepmother had to have told them. She couldn't have kept that secret. And we got a postcard back from them just before we left for Europe, and it had one word on it. It said, Willkommen.
Willkommen.
Willkommen. Well, the welcome. Yeah. And so we went to visit with them, and they were beautifully warm, beautifully warm. But then after that experience, we went up to Hamburg, where Rudy had been a boy, where he'd been born, and he'd lived there until he was four and came across on the ship. And while we were, in the throes of Hamburg and trying to find he wanted to find his daddy's saloon because he was born above it. And the obvious reality was that it was the bombs that had probably destroyed that part of the wharf area.
It could have been one of the bombs from his plane.
It was so ironic. It could have bombed his birthplace. And we were overcome with that kind of reality. And then he wanted to go to a park that was causing him nightmares even then. Like, this is like 30 years later, 40 years later. And in the park, he had lost his caregiver, and it had gotten dark. And he had been racing around a tree trying to find her. Anyway, very poignant kind of afternoon that was. And then we went to the wharf, and he waved to, this is as an adult, he waved to all the big ships coming in because his daddy had been on the big ship, and it was just in his DNA to wave and smile at all the big ships as they came in. And I thought, we might be adults, but we don't change.
Well, you traveled with your husband. You had many years together traveling.
We did.
But then you lose your husband.
That's right.
And I don't even know if that's the word I want to use, because what is your feeling about your husband dying?
Well, I was kind of helped to this, by talking to counselors, that he's not so much gone as he is he's present in a different way. And I've had enough strange events happen to let me believe that that was true. And I think these stronger personalities have a hard time leaving. I don't know how to say that. But they linger, and they linger with us. And I would guess everybody who's lost someone that they've been so intimate and close with has that experience, where they're there. And Rudy's kind of sightings are just a little more dramatic because, of course, they would be.
Well, you tell about this in the epilogue.
Yes.
After you describe your travels, you add a rule in your epilogue.
Yes.
Rudy's rule number 14, don't let death keep you from traveling.
That came to me one night, Nancy. And I thought, that's got to be it. That belongs there.
Because it probably not one that he could have come up with his own. But afterwards,
right.
You have Rudy's Rule 14, don't let death keep you from traveling.
Right. It was whenever I travel that he appeared in some way, in strange ways.
In fact, you start that chapter, today I will go to a funeral, the first since Rudy's death several months ago. I will honor one of his cherished colleagues. And then you come to a point where you couldn't go.
I couldn't do it. I had to do the laundry. I started a load of laundry, and I had to stay and watch it. And So I just really couldn't go to the funeral.
But you did end up going.
I did end up going because he sent a strong message.
So Rudy encouraged you to do that.
Yes, yes.
Now, before we go, I do want to give you a chance to once again say what's going to happen Saturday.
Oh, thank you. Yes, on April 28th, so Saturday, at ABC Bookstore in Mangrove, it's 950 Mangrove, from 11 to 2, we're having a benefit sponsored by the American Association of University Women. And that's a group that I'm a proud member of. It's a group that's done a lot for me in sustaining me through illness and grief and so much. And so I want to be able to give back to them. And they've been working hard on scholarships for local high school senior graduates.
And I think you're going to donate proceeds to the scholarship fund.
Right.
Thank
proceeds
you so,
from the book.
Thank you so much, Mary. It's been a pleasure talking to you about your book, Rudy's Rules for Travel, Life Lessons from Around the Globe. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. We'll be back after a break. WordSpring is a yearly creative writing conference sponsored by the English Department and Associated Students at Butte College. This year's conference takes place on April 28th and features novelist Erica Mailman. Erica Mailman, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
And what will be the focus of your presentation at the writing conference?
Well, I'm doing two, and the first one is called From Murder to Manuscript, because my latest novel is about acquitted murderer. That's a funny way of saying it. Everybody believes she's guilty. Lizzie Borden, who in 1892, Massachusetts, was accused of murdering her stepmother and father by hatchet, very brutally. So the first of my classes is about how to use research if you want to write your own short stories or novel, by utilizing materials you can find, but then also realizing you need to maintain poetic license to craft a good story. And then the second presentation I'm doing is about young adult literature, because I also write YA fiction under a pen name, Lynn Carthage. So I'm going to be talking about how to access that teenaged self who had many highs and lows while trying to develop, you know, as a person of the world. Because for older writers, it can sometimes be hard to remember what it was like to be so fraught with anxiety in those teen years.
So this that you're referring to is writing novels. And you write novels, but I think your primary focus, maybe your literary focus, is historical fiction. Is that true?
That's right. Yeah, I do write YA fiction, but my main focus and the majority of my published novels have been historical fiction.
That happens to be a favorite of mine. What
other? Oh, yay! Me too.
Yes. And the YA, as you use that term, is young adult. Now,
right.
What other books have you written besides the this latest book is The Murderer's Maid, a Lizzie Borden novel? And what other historical fiction books have you written?
I've written a book called The Witch's Trinity, which is about witchcraft in the medieval era in Germany, which, you know, so many people hear about the Salem witchcraft trials and kind of think that that was the, you know, the main encapsulation of witchcraft. But really, in Europe, for over 400 years, women were constantly burned at the stake and accused of witchcraft. And so I wanted to examine that through the lens of an elder woman who's been accused of witchcraft by her own daughter-in-law. because as I learned through research, that was something that happened quite a bit.
And then I believe the San Francisco Chronicle, you got the notable book and Bram Stoker Award finalist for your book, The Witch's Trinity.
Yeah, that was a nice surprise one day to get an email that the Chronicle had named it a notable book. And yes, it was exciting to be a Bram Stoker finalist.
You have a book, The Woman of Ill Fame, and that was Pushcart Press Editor's Book Award nominee. Is that true?
That's true. Yep. And that year they did not name a winner. So in my head, I'm like, oh, I totally had it.
Of course.
They just, I think that press kind of sometimes runs out of funding to do the award every year. But I was nominated. And that is kind of a very fun, rollicking book about a gold rush prostitute who comes to San Francisco in the very beginnings of the gold rush, just determined to get rich. That's her only goal. And she ends up being targeted by a serial killer. And so she needs to kind of figure out who it is. And she's pushed into being an ad hoc detective to kind of save her own life.
Let me remind listeners that you will be here in Chico at Butte College on April 28th. For the 7th annual WordSpring Conference, and you'll be doing a presentation. I believe the title is From Murder to Manuscript, How to Transform Research into a Novel. We'll be looking forward to your visit, Emma. Erica?
Oh, thank you so much. You will be there at the conference?
Actually, I will be in Europe at the time, but I'll be thinking
of
you.
Oh, nice.
So we will look forward to hearing your presentation. Those of us who love writing and those who want to improve their writing, sign up for the 7th Annual WordSpring Conference, April 28th at Butte College, with featured speaker Erica Mailman. Thanks, Erica.
Thank you so much.
You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.